So the, just to read from the verses, it in fact uses that word. So we're in chapter 11, verse in the book of Kings 1, chapter 11, verse 11. No? Hold on. Chapter 11, verse... No, yeah, it's further on. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Verse...
Well, verse 25 starts by Satan with Israel.
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah, that's another one. We have a whole bunch of Satans, actually. Yeah, it starts in chapter verse 14. So it says, Vayakam Hashem, so God rose up, caused to rise, Satan l'Shlomo, a troublemaker to Shlomo. Now, at this time in Tanakh, the word Satan, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but Satan here is only a verb. Or actually, Satan has two uses in Tanakh, in early Tanakh, which this is. Satan is either a job description, a troublemaker, somebody who causes trouble. Or we also have by Bilam, in coming week's parsha, we have lastin, to cause trouble, to stop, maybe even to kill. It's a difficult verb to conjugate. The word shot also is used, which can mean to bang on a horse. They used to bang on horses to create this loud noise, a din of war, to cause the enemy to be frightened. So that's the word lashot. Lashut also means to travel around and jump around from place to place. So those are the word itself has a very interesting etymological derivation. Something's not clear. Good evening. So I'm not going to get into the issue of the Satan right now, but the Satan as a specific angel of God, as a messenger of God, known with a capital S as opposed to a lowercase s, doesn't show up until the later biblical books. So it shows up in Divrei Yamim, which is post-exilic, written by Ezra. It shows up in Zechariah, the famous Satan standing to the right hand or on the left side of Zechariah, causing him problems, causing him trouble, trying to get him killed. So Zechariah is also post-exilic. That's after they came back from the destruction of the first temple and started building the, had prophecies about building the second temple and what it would be like. Some people say the third temple, but here the word Satan simply means troublemaker. I could give a whole shiur on the idea of Satan, but that would really take us out of the way, and I'd rather stick to just the simple meaning in these earlier biblical books. So, let's read a little bit. I think the best way to start is just to read about this Satan of Shlomo and see what he did. His name was Hadad Ha'edomi, so he's an Edomite, which geographically puts you in Eilat and the mountains north of Eilat on both sides of the Jordan River, and that's an important idea. First of all, Eilat was not in Jewish hands at that time, or actually it was starting from David and Shlomo, but before then it was clearly Edomite territory. Not that anybody could really live there so well, but the shipping was out of there, and that's why there was a big deal. We're in chapter 11, verse 14. That's why it was a big deal when Hiram from Lebanon makes this deal with Shlomo, and they build ships, and they send it down to Eilat and to Etzion Gaver to send shipping out of the that's the Gulf of Aqaba, right? The Gulf of Aqaba to the south of, right, to the, of course, because Aqaba is there. That's a big deal, because from there you could essentially plunder the coast of Arabia, and you could also plunder the coast of Africa. That's a very important strategic idea, but it wasn't originally owned by Jews. It was Edomite territory. In fact, it was such Edomite territory that the Jews, when Bnei Israel was on its way around in the desert, God specifically said, don't go through Edomite territory, go around Edomite territory. And then we wanted to go through and just pay a price, and Edomite wouldn't let us go through. It's actually last week's Parsha. But the bottom line is, Hashem says, hands off Edom. You can't make war with them, neither them, nor Moab, nor Ammon, because they're all tribal. They're all from Abraham. So this guy's an Edomite. Mizera melech hu be'edom. So he's related loosely to the king. Vayihi, now this gets a little confusing. Vayihi b'hiyot David et Edom. When David was in Edom, is the way to read that et. Ba'alot Yoav sarat tzava, as Yoav, the officer, David's general, went up l'kaber et ha'chalalim, to bury the corpses, vayach kol zachar be'edom, and he wiped out all males in Edom. Kisheshet, this is not entirely clear who the word he is. The assumption is that it's Yoav, because Yoav is the closest antecedent, so it's probably talking about Yoav doing the deed of killing. Kisheshet chodashim yashav sham Yoav. All right, so Yoav was there for 6 months. Here it's clear. V'chol Yisrael, and he had all of Israel ad echrit kol zachar be'edom, until every male was killed in Edom. first thing I want to establish, it's a very important biblical concept, and I always get in big trouble by saying this, but I got to say it because that's where it itches, so that's where I have to scratch. The word kol doesn't mean kol. I want to establish it's a very important concept. When it says that all the vegetation in Mitzrayim was destroyed, and then there's more vegetation for the arbe to eat afterwards, right after the barad, so there's a medrash about it. The barad struck the vegetation and bent it down, and then the arbe came to eat whatever vegetation couldn't be destroyed. But right there you get a hint the word kol doesn't mean every single one. The reason why I'm emphasizing this is because David seems like a mass murderer. If you read kol, the reason why it's incredibly important to mention here is because if you read Vayach kol zachar be'edom, they murdered and killed every single man in Edom, that's genocide. Genocide. So how do we deal with the idea of genocide and David? Or Yoav? And by the way, the Gemara says there's a big machloket with David. I'm not going to get into too much of the Gemara, but the Gemara says it's a Gemara in Bava Batra, that how Yoav comes back and he only killed all the males. And David said, how come he didn't kill the women also? Because they're Amalek. Which gets you into another problem. Since when is it okay to kill all women, children, and everything else? These are moral issues, which are important issues, but that's another shiur, which I'm not going to get into right now. But I want to... what I want to do here is remove the problem, because if I say the word kol doesn't mean kol, it alleviates for now the difficulty of dealing with morality and Torah. Not that it's a problem that doesn't need to be resolved, but here is not one place that needs to be resolved. What did you want to, jump in?
I was just thinking to Amalek,
but, yeah, there's no doubt that the issue of how morality versus Torah, God's morality, it's God's morality. The same as human morality. Is it different? Is there something else going on by Amalek? Do we have to be apologetic about it? Are Jews a society change so the war no longer exists? We take the easy way out, of course. What's the easiest way out? Amalek doesn't exist anymore. Neither do the seven nations. So therefore, we don't have a problem anymore. But that doesn't really alleviate the original problem. That is, the foundation of the religion, is it established on the idea of genocide? I'm going to avoid that issue now, but I want to demonstrate that, first of all, the word, that the genocide is not at hand here. Good evening. But the word kol doesn't always mean kol, and that's important when you're reading the Torah, because if you read kol always is kol, then you're going to get into all kinds of problems. First of all, it's very interesting. Kol is a noun, not an adjective. In English, all is an adjective. I ate all the apples. In Hebrew, I could demonstrate, but I don't want to take the time right now, that kol is a noun. The way I could demonstrate it is because it forms constructs with other nouns, and it takes upon certain... it acts like a noun. Essentially, it walks like a noun, talks like a noun, quacks like a noun. It's a noun, which immediately tells you that there's something going on. In fact, the word rove in Hebrew, also, the word rove is also a tricky word, because rove in Hebrew, in English is an adjective. It means most. But in Hebrew, it's a noun. Also, demonstrably, you could demonstrate it's a noun, which means, in English, I think you would say the majority, which is different than most. It's a different idea, although I may be splitting hairs too finely. The easiest way to prove that kol doesn't mean kol here, which means David did not order the destruction of every single man in Edom, is by taking a look at the end of this chapter. Take a look to the end of the second Satan. His name was in verse 23. We're in chapter 11. Vayakam Elohim lo Satan. There's another Satan that gave trouble to Shlomo after he committed his sins. Et Rizon ben Eliadash Yabarach made Hadadezer Melech. There was a different locality. He was an Aramite. I'm going to get into that after we finish off with Edom. We're in Malachim Aleph, 1 Kings, chapter 11, verse 24. We jump to verse 24. Vayikbot salav vanashim, vayhisar gdud baharog David otam v'yachud Damesek, v'yeshubam v'yimluchu b'damashik. So whatever it was, David conquered Damesek. This guy managed to run away, and then he came back later, and he ruled in Damesek. Vayihi satan li Yisrael. Look at the next words in verse 25. Kol Yimei Shlomo. He was a Satan to Shlomo. He was a Satan to Israel all the days of Shlomo. Now how do we know kol can't mean kol there? Because if you remember, when things were going very well in chapter 5, what did it say? That there were no Satans to Shlomo. If we take a look, scan back to chapter 5 for a second. Malachim Aleph, I believe it's chapter 5. Let me just take a quick look. I'm not sure. I'll tell you in a second. I'm cheating. I'm using my computer. Yeah. Verse 18. This is when things are going well. This was at the good times of Shlomo's life, career. V'atai niach Hashem Elohai. Shlomo says himself, God has now relieved me, alleviated me, b'saviv, every kind of trouble, ein satan, v'ein fegara. I got no troublemakers and no difficulties. Well, how could it be that Rizon was a troublemaker for Israel all of the days of Israel, if here Shlomo himself attests to the fact that there were no troublemakers? So again, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Maybe they meant from that time forward.
Oh, that's exactly right. And that's exactly right. But you have to read the word, so there you want to change the word Yimei rather than Kol. Or do you want to change the word all of Kol Yimei? You're referring back
if
to...
If you were translating, you would just put in the rest.
The rest of. That's good. That's a perfectly fine way to translate Kol Yimei. But the simple translation of Kol Yimei means the entirety of Shlomo's life. That's why I'm saying when you look at the word kol, you have to be careful here. Kol can either mean the rest of, without necessarily meaning all of the remain. You have to, it does mean an entirety. That does, because it's, again, it's a noun. It's a noun that means the entirety of. Even though, by the way, 9 times out of 10, or 99 times out of 10, when you're reading Torah, you don't have to go bananas. Just treat it as an adjective. But sometimes you clearly have to find it as a noun. It was an entirety of Shlomo's career. Once you make it a noun, now it's an object, like all cars on the road. I don't mean all cars. I mean, you know, the cars that I see. That's the kind of effect that you have. So here's kind of a proof that kol means not kol. And by the way, it has a halachic implications also. It's a famous halacha that rubo kikulo, right? If a kos is filled most of the way, rubo, it's kikulo. It's like most, which means even halachically we understand that if things are 51% and greater, I can employ the word kol. Now, I'm not trying to say that the word kol doesn't ever mean all. I'm sure kol does. If it says vayamat kol banav, I'm sure it didn't mean that whoever got his son killed, they all died. I'm just saying that caution needs to be used here. Now, if we go back, now let's take a look at going back to verse 14 in chapter 11. So it says, verse 15, Vayach kol zachar be'edom. First of all, we know that all the men are not destroyed in Edom. How do we know that all the men are not destroyed in Edom? Because men of Edom show up later and they play an important role in Israeli politics and history, in Malachim Bet as well, in Malachim Bet. What's that? Yeah, well, see there, maybe you may be tempted to say they destroyed everybody but this guy. But that's, I think, not even that. That's not a strong enough reading. It's also possible, it is not impossible, that when it says Vayach kol zachar be'edom, the impression is it's a total destruction. It's a whole of the people were killed. You don't have to say that's 100%. You could say that's 51%. The truth is, you wipe out one out of five men, you could easily call that a kol also. I'm not sure I want to go that way because it's such a massive strike that the word kol could be at play. You could also, if you wanted to, you could also say that it wasn't all zachar, but it was all zachar of the melucha. Why would David want to kill everybody in every single town in Edom? It could have been that he just took the royalty and the people in power and the army and killed them also. The difficulty with that, however, is usually that would say vayach kol ish be'edom, with the word ish, like vayhi ish achad, meramayim sofim. The word ish usually does, who ish gadol, the word ish does imply not just a man, but a very specific man. Zachar is more general. I've alleviated, a little of the problem. We're not talking about genocide here, but we are talking about a massive destruction, and we still have to know why, because why it took place may very much affect what happens afterwards. Unfortunately, this is all the information that we have. Something about dead guys buried, something about, we don't even know what, there's no motive here, we don't know who the Chalalim are, it's a very vague text. Now, we do have another text. I hate to jump everybody around so much, so I'll simply read it. If you don't want to go to it, you don't have to bother. I'll read the whole thing out. It's the original story of Yoav sending people to Edom, David sending Yoav to Edom, and we get a little bit less information, a little bit more information. I'll read it to you. Vayas David, first David was fighting against Aram, which is in the north, Syria and to the north of it, lower Turkey. Vayas David Shem Bishuvo Mehakot et Aram Begay Melach Shmonasar Elef. David made a name for himself. If you want to look it up, it's in Shmuel Bet chapter 8, verse 13. It's in 2 Samuel 8:13. It's a grammatically slightly difficult problem because it sounds like David is beating up on Aram in Gemelech, but that's not how it is. Vayas David Shem, David made a name for himself, in parentheses, Bishuvo Mehakoto et Aram, on the way back from taking care of Aram, Big Gemelech, that is, now he's in Yamamelech, which was that area, Shmonasar Aleph, 18,000. Vayasem Be'edom Nitzivim, and David placed Nitzivim are soldiers, representatives. In modern times, you would call them, what is a Nitziv? A representative of the king, but here we're talking about military, an ambassador, that's correct, but here you're talking about a military presence. Bechol Edom, he put a military presence, all of Edom. Sham Nitzivim, there were ambassadors of war, if you will, everywhere. Vayhi Chol Avadim, Chol Edom Avadim with David, and they stayed as a vassal state to David. Vayosha Hashem et David Bechol Asher Halach. There's a battle with 18,000 dead. There's some kind of Nitzivim, some kind of military presence. That's all we find out. It's hard to say exactly what happened in Edom. But incident up, there's a Tehillim on it. But I'm afraid that if I do the Tehillim on it, if you're curious, it's Tehillim 60, Samach, which talks about this very issue. And it's also very vague, although there it says 12,000, not 18,000. That's not a problem that I'm here to resolve today. Rashi says there were two wars. Could be that there were two different documents with two different numbers on them, and whoever was writing, and Shmuel was in charge of Shmuel Bet, or maybe Natan took the larger number, and somebody else took the smaller number, but that's neither here nor there. Either way, we have a lot of little bit of information, but not quite clear what's going on. My guess, by the way, what the Medrash says, by the way, is that he made a name for himself when he buried the dead. What that is, they take the two psukim together. One is that he made a name for himself in Edom in the Battle of the 18,000. Over by us, it says that David went there and they buried the Chalalim, the dead people, and they beat up on 18,000 people. You all beat up 18,000 people. I want to speculate here. I'll tell you what Chazal said. Chazal said the name they made for themselves that they buried the enemy. They killed 80,000 people, but they buried the enemy, showing this is the way Jews make war, their high moral standard, and that's the way we're going to make war. The only problem with that is if you take a look back in Malachim by us, the word order is backwards. Vayehi biyo David et Adom. David was in Adom. Ba'alot Yoav sarts of ala kaber et achalim. As he went up to bury the dead, Vayach kol zachar be'edom. You see it backwards? First of all, there's no war here specifically. It's not quite clear. This doesn't look like a war. This doesn't look like 18,000. It just says they knocked out all the males. So how do we fit the two psukim together? Not only that, it looks like Yoav is specifically going up there to bury the dead. That is, according to the way Chazal understand it, they were burying the dead because they had a war of 18,000, they buried the dead. Does that mean David was there and he won a war of 18,000 and then he called Yoav to help him bury people? He needs Yoav to help him bury people? I don't understand. Here's my guess of what happened. And sort of fits in with modern day politics. David had a vassal state. And he put representatives, military presence in all of Edom. My guess is that the Edomite government wasn't happy, so they did what happens to insurrectionists when they don't like the military presence. Is that they wiped out the Nitzivim. What? I think they wiped out, I think what they did is they took out a garrison, or two, or ten. That's my guess. Now, I'm just basing this on the word, I'm putting all the psukim together, I really don't have any proof of this, and Chazal don't read it this way. I haven't seen it in Mefarshim either, so this is pure me, so feel free to reject it. But my feeling is he put warriors, remember, really put an emphasis that there were warriors all over Edom. I hate to make a comparison, but think of it like American troops in Iraq today. It's not too different.
Was he occupying the country?
What's that? Occupying. That was what was emphasized in Shmuel. Not only was he occupying it, it specifies it twice. Vayasem Nitzivim, Vayasem Bechol Edom, Vayichol Edom. Because, of course, once you occupy a certain place, you can occupy, let's say, the capital of Edom, but then it'll splinter into groups. You know, you'll have, like, you know, some...
And Edom is the Negev, and around a lot, basically, most of it.
Wish we, if we had a map of Israel, I could describe it a little bit. You know, we may have a... It is not all of the Negev. It would be a picture from Yam HaMelech spreading out on both sides about 20 miles each way. It's called Har Seir on both sides. Do you have a map of Israel? Oh, that's great. Fantastic. Oh, very nice. So Edom territory... Let me stand up because my computer's in the way. Edom territory was from here to the Dead Sea, all the way down to, to the Gulf of Aqaba. That was part of Edom territory, which is said specifically, Shlomo took it away from Edom. But it would also be the mountains here, on this side, called Har Seir. They're red mountains here, and they're very red mountains here. That's Petra and the other iron mountains here. So essentially, they owned this entire block, which is why Bnei Yisrael was really upset after 40 years when they wanted to go through Edom's territory. They were very... See, that explains the parsha, why the Jews were so upset and they wanted to rebel against Moshe. It wasn't because they wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to get to Eretz Yisrael. So they tried going up here, but Edom won't let them in the territory. Then they tried to go here, and Melech Arad comes and gets them. So God says, listen, the only way to go, there's only one way left. Well, actually, they could have gone Eretz Plishtim, but even the first generation couldn't go Eretz Plishtim. The only way was to go all the way around Amon Moab's territory, and then to take Amorite territory and come in on a big flank. But they didn't want to go back to... it was the wrong way. That's like, I don't know, it's just like if I want to go to Boston, I start traveling towards Florida, it just gives you a bad feeling. And they were really very upset about it. They weren't upset because they wanted to go back to Egypt. They were upset because they thought Moshe was giving them problems. Which explains, by the way, the double letter. Do you remember in the Parsha, first Moshe sends a letter and says, we want to go through Edom. And then there's a second letter that Bnei Yisrael sends out and says, we want to go to Edom. What happened with the first letter? They already got a no. So according to some, they sweetened up the deal, but I think a better opinion is that they just, Bnei Yisrael didn't accept that Moshe was going to take them all the way around. I mean, really, can you imagine having, you know, let's say 2 to 3 million people and saying, well, we can't get through to Israel, which you could actually see, so we're going to take about 6 months and take a little hiking tour all the way down and then all the way back around these mountains in the middle of the summer. And so that was something that upset them very much. So that would be this entire territory here. Thanks. Let's continue on. So, again, this is pure speculation, but the way the Pesukim read to me, my guess is that Edom revolted, wiped out the Nitzivim, and back then you didn't have a press that you were worried about. That is, back then, if somebody wiped out your soldiers, if you had a vassal state and you put soldiers in that state to control that state, and insurgents / run by the government wipes out your soldiers, what you do is you go in and you teach them a lesson that they'll never forget. That works. It's not very politically correct, certainly not today. It's not the kind of thing that happens today. Well, it does sometimes happen today, but it's something that certainly today it tends to be frowned on as imperialism at its worst. What's that? Well, I could argue Israel. You know, the Intifada was partially suppressed when they started shooting missiles at all the leaders. And that did a good job at that's good job. You don't find that in America. You don't have missiles striking in America. The presence in Iraq, you have
missiles.
You do, but I think it's carefully done. You know what I'm saying? That is, I think the Americans are aware that the camera's on them when they're going into these things. And at some point, you know, they just said, forget it, we're just going in. And then look what happened. They had that story about the American soldier that killed the guy who was lying down, and there was a whole. No, but I'm saying that's. I, in combat situations, I completely feel. I mean, I have to say, I don't usually bring politics here, but I think the guy was under major stress. And if there's any doubt whatsoever, sure. I agree.
So
I think that's why the guy let off. I think it's pretty clear in a combat situation that you do what you need to do. But the press is still there, take a look at it. There was a big, back then you didn't have this kind of problem. You had neither political correctness nor did you have the BBC. So without those two things, you had a certain free hand. I'm not justifying, again, I'm going to avoid the issue of whether we can fit our morality into this morality. But at the time, vassal states, if you had a vassal state, they decide to non-vassalize, not by sending any more taxes, but by wiping out your military presence. My guess is you sent them up and you taught them a lesson. In fact, Edom would be suppressed until it's going to become an issue in Malachim Bet in about 10, 12 chapters when Edom finally breaks away. But we find that Edom actually helps Israel in a war. Jehoshaphat, who's a great king, who joined up with Ahab and Edom to fight against the Moabites, the famous Mesha. We have a Mesha tablet with a famous story about how he fights against the Jews and actually wins, fights against the Israelites. So according to Tanakh, Edom was on our side, because that's a lesson that you don't likely forget. So I spent a lot of time sort of setting that up. You could like it or not like it, but the bottom line is there's something going on in Edom. And the way that it works out for me sensibly is the way that I described it. If we went through that Tehillim, by the way, if you get a chance, look in that Tehillim Samach, because it seems to indicate that they were fighting a war that they were losing at first. David gets very upset. He reads Tehillim. Things go the other way, but it wasn't an easy battle either way. Anyway, let's continue on. because things actually get a little bit weird. Yud Zayin, verse 17, chapter 11. Vayivrach Adad. By the way, Adad doesn't make much of a difference. If you speak to an Israeli, you can't hear hey anyway. To, you know, these days, and back then similar. Vayivrach Adad huv anashim Adomiim. So he ran away with some Edomites. Me'iv me'avdei Aviv. He told Avo Mitzrayim v'Hadad Narkatan. So he's still a young servant. Vayakumi Midian, Vayavo. So first he runs to Midian, which I think probably is a little further out into the Arabian desert, a little deeper into what we know of as the Arabian Jordanian desert. Vayakumi Midian, Vayavo Paran. So he goes to Paran, which is back now in southern Israel, the Negev, where very few people live. Vayichu Anashim Imami Paran. So he gets some more Edomites that are still there. Vayavo Mitzrayim O Paro Melech Mitzrayim V'Yitain Lo Bayit. V'lechem amarlo v'eretz natan lo. So he makes friends with Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Now this is a little confusing because, don't forget, Paro Melech Mitzrayim is the father-in-law of Shlomo. Right? Shlomo marries Paro's daughter. That makes the person who's putting up Hadad his father-in-law. Not only that, the relations were apparently good, because we saw that Paro, when he actually attacked a difficult-to-attack city in Israel called Gezer, he conquered Gezer and gave it to Shlomo as a wedding gift, a dowry gift for his wife, a wedding gift for his daughter. So far, okay. It's okay. I mean, there's nothing terrible about this guy's an Edomite. It's been a long time since David had a big grudge against the Edomites for wiping out his soldiers, if my read of the Tanakh is correct. If my read is not correct, there's certainly no grudges, so Paro could put up whoever he wants. By the way, the word amar should be read as the word command. V'lechem amarlo, he commanded him bread, and we actually have cases of that where, you know, the king has documents, we have ancient documents that say, give this guy who was a former ruler, he's now living in my country, I want him to have X amount of bread per day. It was part of an allocation that he would get. The Eretz Natan gave him a little bit of country. It's very nice. He's a dupe. Vayimtza dad chayim b'enei paro ma'od. A lot of he found pleasure in his eyes. Vayitain lo isha et achot ishto achot tachpenei sagvira. He's married into the family now. He's married to the sister of Paro's wife. They're brother-in-laws now. That's significant. His wife's name was Tachpanes. Vatel lo achot Tachpanes et gnuvat b'no. He gave birth to a son. Vatag mileu Tachpanes betoch beit paro. What does that sound like to you? Vatig mileu Tachpanes. And Tachpanes, who is the wife of Paro, raises this child as her own in the house of Paro. What does that sound like? Sounds like Moshe. If I only had that connection, that would not be enough, but I'll prove to you that I have more. Do you follow? What's going on here is insidious. Again, the Navi, we saw last week, the Navi didn't want to come out and really say exactly what he wanted to say to Shlomo. He didn't do that. Shlomo was a tzaddik in his own way.
It gets worse.
But right now the comparison is, this boy, this Gnuvad, is compared to Shlomo. Because Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe, what? I guess by relation. I'm not sure how tight it was, but I'm more concerned about the fact that this little child is raised in the house of Paro. Those words, the very phraseology, were chosen by the prophet to remind you, Moshe. They want you to go look up Sefer Shemot to make sure the words match. By the way, they do. Feel free to take a look. Not exactly, but close enough to give you the impression. Vayihi gnuvat beit Paro betoch bnei Paro. He was the next in line to be the king. V'hadad shama b'mitzrayim ki shachad Davidim avatav ki meit Yoav sar tzava. And Hadad heard from Mitzrayim that David died and Yoav died. Now what does this sound like? Remember when Moshe hears that Paro is dead?
The whole generation. Oh no, that was...
There was a part in where Moshe hears that the king who is after him dies. This phraseology, it's not an exact match, but it's a little bit suspicious. That is, keep in mind now that Hadad is in exile. And he hears that the people who wanted to kill him are no longer alive, which allows him to come out of exile. That sounds also exactly like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is in exile in Midian. And by the way, where did Hadad run away to first in order to escape the... He ran away to Midian first before he went back to Edomite territory. He couldn't live in Edomite territory. Because who is in charge there? David and Shlomo. which means if you're making a musal, David and Shlomo are equal to, if you compare it to Shemot, David and Shlomo, or actually Shlomo is really being compared to who, in a sense?
Shlomo?
To Paro. You see what I'm saying? That is just like Moshe was on the run from Paro in Midian, Hadad is on the run in Midian from somebody. Who is that somebody? David and Yoav. And by substitution, Shlomo. Vayomer Hadad el Paro, Shacheni Beilecho Atzi, I want you to send me back to my people. What does this sound like? Whose conversation is this? Do you remember the conversation with Yitro? Moshe says, listen, give me permission to go back? The whole thing going on, you see? Vayomer lo Paro, Kimata Chaseri Mi, why are you going back for? You want to go back to your country? Vayomer lo. So Paro doesn't want him to go. He probably doesn't want him to go because he probably knows what kind of trouble he's going to cause for Israel. Vayomer lo ki shaleach d'shalchein mi, send me. Vayak, all right, so that's it. And that's the end of the story. And obviously he caused tremendous problems, all kinds of fights. Now he's back in Edomon territory. Once upon a time, Eilat was secure, and now you can imagine that now I have to garrison, Shlomo had to garrison all kinds of soldiers to make sure that his ships could sail successfully out of Eilat, because all of a sudden the insurgents are back, and Edomite territory is not quite as secure as it was before. The very fact that we have so much details makes you want to draw a comparison, because the Torah is not, Torah and Navi is not a history book. What's the proof? Because the next Satan, Razon, only gets two psukim. The Navi doesn't have any fancy things to say about Razon. What do I need to hear the whole Hadad story? Now, if I was going to introduce Hadad as a major character for the rest of Sefer Melachim, okay, I need to know who he is. But I never do. Tach Banes, I get the name of the Gvira, the woman, like she's like Bat Paro hanging out by the, you know, by. I get personalities here. I get a story, and he heard, and I said, he went to his father-in-law, so to speak, and he said, listen, I want to go back to my country. And his father-in-law's like, maybe you shouldn't go. And he goes, I really want to go. Once you get all of that background, you know that somebody's trying to tell you something. To my mind, unfortunately, I think what's trying to be told us, unfortunately, the muscle is, to my mind, quite clear and quite harsh. Hadad is being compared to Shlomo HaMelech, to Moshe Rabbeinu. Shlomo is being compared to a certain degree to Paro. Everything is backwards. And that shouldn't surprise us at all, because if you remember when we went into all Shlomo's problems, what was the whole difficulty there? He married Bat Paro, which maybe was okay, and maybe wasn't okay. And then he took all the chariots, and then he sent guys to do export, and all the things that he wasn't supposed to do in Mitzrayim, Shlomo did. And he built Arei Miskanot. Do you remember that? This was already from, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago. He built Arei Miskanot in chapter 10. There's only one guy who builds Arei Miskanot, and that's Paro. Well, there are two guys in Tanakh who build Arei Miskanot. That's Paro and Shlomo. That Shlomo was very much affected by his wife, Bat Paro, and very much affected by the power of the Egyptian culture, and he went with it. And what's the ultimate proof? Let's take a look at the third Satan. The third Satan is a homegrown. He's a family man. Yerovam ben Nevat. Yerovam ben Nevat will be the leader of the split kingdom. In the meantime, now he's working for Shlomo. Let's read verse 26, 27, 28. The Yerovam ben Nevat Ephrati, who's from Shevet Ephraim, Minat Sreda, that's the name of the place. Vishemi Mo Tzrua, his mother's name was Tzrua, Yishal Mana, Eved L'Shlomo, he's a servant of Shlomo, Vayarim Yabmel. He lifted his hand against the king. What that is, we'll get into perhaps later. We may save it, though. V'zah Devar Sherim B'Yad Melech Shlomo. I'm going to tell you what he did. I'm sorry. V'zah Devar Sherim B'Yad Melech. I want to tell you exactly what the rebellion was. And now, of course, what do you expect? You're all waiting for what? The description of rebellion. But you don't get a description of the rebellion. But whatever the rebellion was caused based on what Shlomo does. What does Shlomo do? Shlomo builds the Milo. The Milo is the landfill between Har Tzion and Har and Har Abayit, and he landfills the whole thing in so people could build a house there. In fact, earlier on, I don't want to take the time to jump in, but if you take a look in chapter 9, there's a specific house that's built on top of the Milo. What is it? The house of Bat Paro is built on the Milo. So it's all, I think it all becomes very clear. Sagar Peretz Ir David Aviv, and that's a little unclear. He closed up the openness of the city. Va'ish Yeravam Gibor Chayel Va'yar Shlomo Tanar Kiosem Lachahu. Now we're sort of jumped back in time for some reason. Shlomo sees how good Yeravam is. Vayafkeid Oto, and he points him to what? L'chol Sevel Beit Yosef. That's a very indicative word, that word Sevel, because it sounds, what does it say by Hashem? Vayishmad Kol Sivlotam. They heard all the troubles of the Jews in Mitzrayim.
The way, you know,
In fact, that's even from this parsha. When Yisrael, from last week's parsha, when Israel sends a letter to Edom asking it to go through. So here's the pasuk. It's in Chukat. Good thing about actually paying attention to Torah reading, since that actually helps out these Syrians. Tinkas, Balak, Chukat. Vayishlach Moshe Malachim Mikadesh Melech Edom Ko Amar Achicha Yisrael Ata Yadata. Oh, is it here? Oh, maybe I'm wrong. It doesn't use the word Sevel here. Ata Yadata Ekol Atla Hashem Atza'anu Vayerdu Avotenu Mitzrayim Veneishim Mitzrayim Mirabim Vayera Mitzrim Avotenu. I apologize. The word Sevel is not here. Well, I guess maybe I should pay attention better to my Torah read. I thought it was here, but it's certainly in Shemot. The word kol tacha kol sivlotam. The word sevel actually, etymologically, it's not a difficult word. Sevel means to carry a weight. I don't think that they were slaves in the sense that I don't think Ephraim were slaves in the sense that the Jews were slaves in Mitzrayim. I don't think that. I think that they were weight carriers. They carried stones. They carried stuff. They were doing hard work. They were called baal sevel. However, the fact that the Navi uses the word l'chol sevel beit Yosef, which is a very Egypt-reminiscent word, right after we have this whole story about Egypt, I think it paints a picture. And I think what the Navi is trying to say is, you know, the problem with the wives, forget about. The problem with the Avodah Zarah, forget about. In a classic Mida Kenegan Mida, measure for measure, it's indicative that Shlomo, who's married to Bat Paro, is being Satan'd, is being troubled by a guy who comes out looking exactly like Moshe. And I think that what the Navi's saying is, you know, the table's turned. If you want to walk like an Egyptian and talk like an Egyptian and clap like an Egyptian, then expect what happened to the Egyptians. You know, you can't have, you can't have half the cake and then leave the part that you don't like. And I think that's a very gentle, I mean, it's really quite gentle. I think it's easy to miss the whole story of how Hadad essentially turned Shlomo. Hadad becomes the boy who was saved, right? He was a little kid and he's saved and he runs to Midian and he's raised in Pharaoh's house and Pharaoh says, don't go. And he says, no, I want to go back to my home. All of a sudden, Hadad's the new is the new Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's a criticism. That's a criticism because the minute that the bad guys could become the good guys, and the good guys become the bad guys, then you clearly have your moral compass all backwards. It's not a question. The Avodah Zarah was not that Shlomo worshiped Avodah Zarah. That we talked about in the previous Shurim, but he allowed people to worship Avodah Zarah. Why did he allow it to happen? Not because he was a bad guy, not because he didn't believe in God and only one God, but because his moral compass was all off.
Show actually that he assimilated to the point that he...
Of Egyptian culture, I think there was a certain amount of assimilation, if only on the economic... I don't think on the religious scale, that would be hard to press. But on the economic scale, on the social scale, yeah, I'm not here to be political, but, you know, a Jew living in America is, you know, very much affected by Americanisms. If America's a good country, that's a positive thing. If America's a bad country, that's a negative thing. I don't know, it's hard for me, I don't want to bring up Jews in Germany, because the Holocaust, it changes everything. But didn't the Jews in Germany in the late 1800s and early 1900s feel very much German? I think they went to Heidel's, they went to the universities, they had the face scars.
Very much.
I think they were very...
German first, then Jews.
What's that?
German first.
And then Jews. And I don't think they gave up their religion, per se.
No. But they were very patriotic. Absolutely. Very much.
So I think that winds up, you know, inevitably that winds up getting... And the minute that your whole mandate is to not be like Egypt... That's the mandate of the king. So the minute you step away from that, that's exactly the kind of culture that
culture is now. That's not the same, because if you want to use the example of Germany, Germans in their own country, here we have a king who adopts Egyptian way of life. Isn't it much more like later on the Hellenistic, when they adopt the Hellenistic way of life?
Yeah, that's possible, though Hellenism by itself, I think, was a religion. Helena was a religion, so therefore it came into direct conflict, I think. Not just, I agree with you, there was absolute cultural conflict. The gymnasiums, you know, the sports and the events and the bathhouses and everything else that was Greek. But because Hellenism was specifically a religion, I think that came into, that probably produced more of a conflict than we're seeing here. Hellenism was ready to destroy Israel. I don't think Egyptianism here is ready to destroy Israel, but I think it is ready to split it into two. That I do believe.
Egyptian was the power at that time.
That's correct.
They basically arranged itself as the major power.
That is, what's that?
He arranged himself as the major power.
Yeah, although Shlomo shouldn't have, because the nice thing about Shlomo for the first years in his life is something happened to him that never happened in Egypt before. He got the king's wife. It was usually the other way. You read documentation, you never have Paro giving out his wife. It was always Paro of Egypt. Egypt was always such a power player that they were taking in wives. The one who gets the wife is the one who's more powerful. Shlomo was in a position of probably greater power to a certain degree. He was certainly in a better geographical economic situation. He was much better in shape than Egypt was. He controlled now the Gulf of Aqaba. He had friends to the north. He made a treaty to the south with Sheba. He had a treaty to the north with Lebanon. So essentially, he's got the north, south, and east-west trade routes. He's got from Mesopotamia to the Aegean Islands, and he's got from Anatolia, Turkey, all the way down to Egypt. He really controls the whole thing. So to a certain extent, you know, whether they would have been able, man for man, probably Egypt had 10 times more soldiers. But economically, I think Shlomo was in the situation to keep himself from absorbing too much Egyptian culture. And in fact, that's what the command in Devarim says. Devarim says, don't take too many horses. Don't take too many wives. That's Egyptian. Don't do it. It says specifically, don't go down to Egypt. Don't be like Egypt like you were before. Don't take too many horses from Egypt. And everybody freaks out. Why horses from Egypt? So everybody says, because that's where most horses were. But I think it was a more cultural issue than just the practicality of that's where the horses were. How are we doing on time? Oh, we're doing okay. So I think here, again, the criticism is very subtle, but I think it's very, very important what the Navi is saying here. Navi is saying that the moral compass is swung north is south, south is north. I no longer know who's right anymore, to the point that Edomites may be right and Shlomo may be the bad guy. And that's a real problem. That's a real difficulty, and that ultimately is what the Navi is saying about the fall, the bad years of Shlomo, probably the last 10 years of his life. Just to do Razin a little bit, going back to verse 23, chapter 11, verse 23, Vayakem Elohim lo Satan et Rizon ben Eliada asher barach made Hadadezer mel Tzova Adonav. So there's a famous battle David beats up on Aram Tzova, which is also, by the way, in that Tehillim 60, so if you get a chance, it's very much worth a look. These are Aramites. These are people who are related to us. These are close family members. But they're not from the tribe of Avram. Edom, partially, is from Esav. Esav, I doubt, founded Edom. I doubt it very much. But he certainly formed a great fighting force in Edom, and he probably imprinted his people with Edom, plus he married Yishmael. Edom was really a country name. It was called Edom. I mean, one of the reasons why we say it's called Edom, of course, is because of the red soup and the, you know, the fact that he was sort of maybe like had red hair all over the place, or he was covered with hair. But of course, Edom is probably also called Edom. The question is, who adopts who? Which name is adopted first? Edom is called Edom. Anybody who's been to Petra or even in Israel during those mountains, they're full of iron and they look red, and that's why the land is called Edom. And it was called Edom long before there was it's documented, actually. It was called the land of Edom, you know, way before Esav adopted that. It became Esav's colors, if you will. But Esav certainly didn't found the nation of Edom, although he may have been its first perhaps driving force towards civilization, because what Esav brought down was Avram's idea of civilization, which was founded in Mesopotamia. So Mesopotamia, of course, comes out of the twin rivers. Edom, essentially, they're what we would call Arabs today, really, although there was no such thing as Arabs back then, but the people who, their trade, they lived in the desert. They couldn't have too many people. Water was scarce. It was a hard job to find. They made their money on trading. They were loosely configured people without really any kind of formalized, organized civilization. They were nomads, Bedouins, in the most maximalist sense. So after Mesopotamia's culture sort of slides all the way up to where Avram's father was from, Haran, so when Avram moves down and takes that into Canaan, so it's not surprising that Edom would then bring that, you know, that Esav would start to perhaps catalyze the Edomite forming into more nationhood rather than just being scattered bands. Of course, the Torah doesn't specifically tell us this. It just tells us that he founded Edom. History doesn't tell us this, so there's no guy named Esav, you know, that we've dug up in documentation. The chances are would be small that he even kept that name, even if we would find him mentioned. But nonetheless, that's probably what is going on here. The northern kings, however, Aram, that's our family. That's not Avram's children. That's Avram's brothers and Avram's cousins and Avram's great-grandparents. Hi, things went south?
Apparently so.
Okay. I'll tell you how it ends. and I'll take care of this. Like, just this? Lay? Just these three things? Okay. So the Aramites are to the north. Aram Sova is probably in northern Syria, almost southern Turkey. And there was another guy, but we don't know much about him, but simply that Israel was getting it both on the north and both on the south. Let's do a little about Yeruvim, and then we'll finish up there. Yeruvim is the real problem, because Yeruvim is an internal. So we read about the fact that Shlomo built the Milo. I don't want to take the time to prove it, because I'd have to search for it. Actually, you know what? I could do that with my computer. Just a second. But the Milo was, I'll ask you to trust me if I can find it, the Milo was where Paro's, Bat Paro's house was built. He specifically built it for on the Milo. I think it's in the area, I think it's the fact that you could walk, when you walk into Shar Yafo, on the right-hand side is Har Tzion, that's David's territory. The fact that you could just walk straight through the Har Abaya, through the Armenian section, I think that's pretty much because there's a Milo. That is the...
Towards the Kotel.
I think towards the Kotel. That is the area between Har Abayit and Har David, I believe was kind of a deep ravine in between. And what he did was he built the area up between that. I'm not sure about that because I'm not really big on archaeology. We probably do better by looking at a good book in archaeology and just look up the word Lancel and Shlomo. You could find something good. But I believe it's the area between the two mountains. The fact that Jerusalem is as flat, more or less, as it is on the top area... But I'm not entirely sure. Somewhere in that area, I believe, connecting those two mountains. The other thing that happens is that he does two things. Shlomo builds the Milo, which we have to sort of figure out by looking up the Milo, that has to do with Bat Paro. And Ephraim probably went over to him and said, what you did was the wrong thing. Something else goes on, though. Shlomo also closes up the hole. Sagar Peretz Ir David Aviv. So first of all, we know the word Ir David Aviv immediately tells you, that's a puzzle that says the Navi's trying to tell you something. Ir David is obviously his father's city because he's Shlomo ben David. You see what I'm saying? The minute that it says Ir David Aviv, somebody is trying to tell you something, and the question is what? I don't know for sure, but I can tell you what Medrash says. Medrash builds this unbelievable story. They paint Yeruvim as a good guy, and they combine this pasuk together into this beautiful story, which I don't think should be understood literally, but I think it tells you what politically is going on behind the scenes. Yeruvim is his right-hand man. And Shlomo, one day, after he finishes building the house for Paro, the house for Bat Paro, throws this massive party. Massive party. He's up all night reveling, all for the sake of Bat Paro, who he marries at this time. Because if you remember from earlier on, it looks like the marriage didn't actually take place until the house was done, perhaps. So the Medrash says he was partying for his new wife that he just built this landfill for and the house for. And he falls asleep. The key to the Beit HaMikdash, which he's already built previously, is under his head, and nobody could get it. So they can't go in that day. He oversleeps because he's had a long night of partying. And he nobody can get into the Beit HaMikdash. You have to understand what the Medrash is doing here. This is not a story to be understood literally, but what it's doing is it's connecting, it's doing a comparison. Because of what you did for, you see the muscle here, the parable is beautiful. And Chazal talk like the Nevi'im, they talk in parables. Because you built, you focused on Bat Paro, caused you to unfocus on Har Abayit, on the temple. It's not that he was sleeping on the key. I doubt there was a key in the sense like they didn't have a spare key, you know, there was nobody getting in. There's a lock on the door of the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen wasn't in charge, they couldn't break down the doors and muscle it in. I mean, it's a preposterous story if read literally, and that's always the problem with reading these Midrashim literally. Chazal sound stupid almost, unless you just want to buy the whole thing, they really sound idiotic. But if you understand that they're trying to make it's a parable, and they're trying to say, because of your focus on Bat Paro, caused you to hurt the focus on the temple, that's a beautiful tale. What happens? Yeruvim ben Nevat comes in and says, you did the wrong thing. You're sleeping on the keys to the temple. A. And B, your father took the walls of this city, which originally, by the way, was walled before David. It was walled by the Yebusim, who were there first. And David knocked down, oh, it's almost time for, I'm sorry, it's almost time. I'll finish just now. David knocked down all these holes in the wall so that people could come to Yerushalayim with no problem. And you filled up all the holes to the city, meaning you closed off the city. And he was punished for that, because even though he told Shlomo good mussar, he told it to him in front of the whole crowd and embarrassed Shlomo, that's why he deserved to die. Okay, again, that's a little confusing. But what they're accusing Shlomo of is a really beautiful thing. One is a focus on Mitzrayim, but the second thing is militarizing Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim in David's time became an open city. There was no wall around Yerushalayim. David plowed gigantic, almost like the conqueror came in through Yaffa Gate, didn't want to walk through Yaffa Gate, so he knocked down the wall. David also knocked down a lot of walls. He wanted people to come into Yerushalayim. But Shlomo apparently rebuilt the walls, turning it back into a fortress, and that was something that Yerubim told him was bad. Shlomo rejects that advice, tries to kill him, he runs away, and Yerubim runs away to none other than Paro. And that's where we'll pick up we'll probably pick up the story there, or that's pretty much the end of Shlomo. So we will maybe do the Beit HaMikdash next week.
Is this the new time?